From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. You don't need me to tell you that opportunities for voices of inclusivity and moderation to be heard are far too rare in our country these days, and just when they are needed the most. Since our very first broadcast in 2006, State of Belief Radio has been committed to amplifying these voices, presenting conversations that underscore not just that cooperation and mutual respect are possible, but that they are absolutely essential to our very survival. And so I invite you to help keep this show on the air by making a generous donation today. Please visit stateofbelief.com for all the details. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
We lift our hands in prayer as a nation, and he can't hear our prayers over the pleas of the blood of the unborn.
It's been an absolute cornerstone of conservative Christianity in this country. Abortion is murder. It's driven evangelicals to the polls in single-minded fervor. It's inspired political candidates to pander with claims such as conception resulting from a rape must be the will of God. It has one federal official forcibly preventing multiple refugee rape victims from accessing abortion services. They are so very certain that this is what God wants. A provocative article headlined, Pro-Born. A former evangelical on the single-issue politics of white Christians appeared recently in Religion Dispatches magazine, and the author, Dr. Bradley Onishi, will be with us this week on State of Belief.
Clergy who do actual damage to souls with their heresy. Father James Martin, for example, is allowed to maraud all over the world with his incessant gay garbage.
He's an acclaimed public speaker, popular author, longtime editor of America magazine, and mild-mannered Jesuit priest named to the Vatican Secretariat of Communication. The same guy a New York Times headline recently labeled the scariest Catholic in America. I'll try to find out why later in the hour when Father James Martin returns to State of Belief Radio. But first,
politicians who sit in their gilded House and Senate seats funded by the NRA telling us nothing could ever be done to prevent this. We call BS! They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS! They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call BS! They say guns are just tools like knives and are as dangerous as cars. We call BS! They say that no laws could have been able to prevent the hundreds of senseless tragedies that have occurred. We call BS! That us kids don't know what we're talking about, that we're too young to understand how the government works. We call BS!
In the weeks since the horrific mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, we've seen activism and organizing around reducing gun violence in this country continue in a way that's different from previous massacres. Perhaps the articulate survivor student activist captured the media's attention more effectively than previous efforts. Perhaps instead of becoming numb to the frequency and size of recent shootings, Americans are finally, truly fed up. Notably, this week, Vox reported that since that terrible Valentine's Day, one more thing has been different. there has not been a surge in gun sales like we saw incredibly right after other mass shootings in recent years. So with national events around this issue scheduled for the weeks ahead, I wanted to take a look at the intersection between this brave, noisy, sometimes profane new crop of activists and some of the faith-inspired work against gun violence that has been going on for years. And to do that, I'm very happy to be joined by my good friend, the Reverend Jennifer Butler, Executive Director of Faith in Public Life. Jennifer, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you, Welton.
I think we've all been inspired by the direct and honest way a lot of these Florida students have stepped up almost immediately after their school family was decimated by gunfire and haven't let up since. What does that make you think and feel?
Well, one, it makes me remember that there are so many social justice issues in our lives that we think, will we ever change this? Can we ever move the needle on this? And what the faith community is so good at doing, I think, is having that faith and that hope and that belief that if you step out on faith, that that is what is required and that eventually there will be change. And I think what these young folks are teaching us is, one, that young people can make an enormous difference and that moral outrage can make an enormous difference. One of the things that I love about what they're doing is they are just speaking straight from their hearts and their minds. You know, they're not scripted. They're not messaged. They are just expressing pure moral outrage at what happened to their friends.
Yeah.
And it's just a reminder to continue in our activism and to know that change will come.
How do you think this time could be different from the calls for change that followed past mass shootings in this country?
Well, I think, you know, in this case, the actual victims are old enough to be able to organize and to speak for themselves. And I have been talking with folks who are close to the organizers, and it really is a youth-led movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what is really unique here.
Faith in Public Life has a long history of effective work around gun violence. I'd like, if you would, you briefly to describe some of that work that has gone on.
Yes. Well, faith leaders have been organized all over the country and states to roll back and oppose any laws trying to permit the carrying of guns in all quarters of life. So, for example, in Georgia, we are working with a coalition called Outcry. And they have been opposing some of the measures there. Basically, they had a guns everywhere bill. And they also had a bill coming forward that would push public college campuses to allow guns on campus. Mm-hmm. And so the religious leaders there were able to organize to lift up an alternative voice in a very conservative state. There was one year where they were able to get the governor to veto the campus carry bill. And they're continuing to build support within the state and now have over 1,000 clergy around the state working together to end gun violence.
Mm. So here's one thing that I think is really important to get right at this particular moment. We've all heard the Parkland students talk defiantly about the failures of past generations to do anything substantive about school safety and gun violence. Obviously, success in demanding change will require both institutional activism and the kind of grassroots passion the survivors have inspired. So, Jennifer, how do we move toward trust between those two groups?
Well, we have to put the students and their movement first and their leadership first. They're the ones who are leading us out of the wilderness. They're planning marches around the country on March 24th, the March for Our Lives. There will be marches in over 400 locations around the country, and that's probably growing every day. So I encourage people to Google March for Our Lives and sign up to be a part of those events. And the greatest thing about this is that these youth really are leading this movement. They've brought a circle of people around that can help advise them. But there will be, for example, at the march in Washington, D.C., it will be all speakers under, I think, age 21. And so I think coming in and supporting and allowing them to lead and asking them what we can do to help, but allowing their voices to be up front is really critical at this moment, as it is in any movement that begins to take off. We want to make sure that those who have led, that their interests and their voices are honored.
Do you have any concerns about bringing together the people with whom you've been working all of these years and these people who are new to the movement?
Not at all. You know, as long as we're respecting their leadership, and I know they welcome us, they want folks around the country, in particular, supporting local events. As long as we're standing behind them and not trying to stand up front, that's what's important. And congregations and religious communities across this country are going to be so critical to interpreting what has happened in Florida and using this moment for change and for discourse and conversation within their own communities. And so what the rest of us really can do, too, is begin these conversations. This is a great moment to have really respectful conversations in our own communities and have people start to talk about this again.
Well, you're modeling exactly what needs to be going on. What advice would you have for other longtime activists who may find it difficult to connect with the surge of youthful energy that's driving the conversation right now?
Well, I think we should just be joyful and grateful for what's happening. And it's happened throughout our history, right, that young people eventually lead the way. And I think it's important to, you know, sign up on their list and find ways that we can weigh in and be supportive. They're certainly going to need folks, you know, around them. And as they lead, we're going to learn a lot, right? We're going to learn a lot from this generation that understands social media in different ways, that has its own message and heart, and is going to even lead with different language. And so that's how we continue to grow throughout our lives. And it's really exciting to see.
But you know, Jennifer, I think it is also important for these youngsters to learn from some of the things that have been done that you have been doing. How would you caution them not to burn out, not to lose hope, and most important, not to give up when there are setbacks and when the exhilaration of media attention inevitably fades? I think you have wise counsel to give there.
Yeah, that is a really good point. I mean, I would say to all of them to find moments in the midst of the storm where they can take a couple of hours to recharge. And that is always really hard to do. We all think in moments like that if we step out, everything will fall apart. And what I've learned time and time again is when I do step out, nothing falls apart, especially when you have a team around you. It's sort of that sense we have of our own importance. But when you're part of a movement, others can fill in. Your health is important. I find whenever I step away, I come back more creative and more energized for the long haul. It is good to know that the tension that is on them right now will eventually wane, although not entirely. And so that will feel really different. I know, you know, for us, this year feels a little different than it did last year, right after the election. But the energy is there. It's just sort of a deeper ongoing pulse rather than a rapid pulse. And so just knowing that there's a season to every movement and that is okay is important to know as well.
Give our listeners just a quick overview of the range of issues Faith in Public Life works on and how they can keep up with and support that work.
Well, yeah, thank you. We have been working really hard to support Dreamers. As you know, the deadline for them was March 5th, and so a lot of them are now living in limbo and without protections. And so we helped organize last week a vigil by Catholic leaders. About 20 sisters, Catholic sisters or nuns, came from around the country And you may have seen they also engaged in civil disobedience, saying, in effect, arrest a nun, not a dreamer. We'll be continuing to organize around the country. We organize nationally, but also in states. And so we have networks in places like Georgia and Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, Ohio. If folks want us to get active in their state on an issue, we're happy to do that as well. In Ohio, we're working on criminal justice reform. In Georgia, we're working on gun violence and non-discrimination issues to protect the LGBTQ community. So you can check out our website at www.faithinpubliclife.org or follow us on Twitter at TheRealFPL and get engaged in some of the issues. Our focus is really on lifting up the moral voice and the faith voice around these issues that we care so deeply about.
The Reverend Jennifer Butler is the founding executive director of the organization Faith in Public Life, which addresses a wide range of social justice and human rights challenges in our nation and in our world. Reverend Butler is the author of the book Born Again, The Christian Right Globalized. Jennifer, your work on these critical issues is so valuable. You're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It is great to be on the show.
We're just getting started with this week's show. I'll talk with Father James Martin, whose controversial book, Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity, has just been revised. And later, the writer of the Religion Dispatch's article, Pro-Born, a former evangelical on the single issue politics of white Christians, Dr. Brad Onishi. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. The scariest Catholic in America. Sure, it was a sympathetic Frank Bruni article, but still, that was the New York Times headline referring to Father James Martin. I don't think it will surprise you to hear that I can absolutely relate, having walked away from the politicized Southern Baptist Convention in the bright spotlight of conservative public opinion. At issue is Father Martin's brave and deeply inspiring book titled Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. It came out last summer and has just been released in a fully revised paperback edition, and I am delighted that it brings the author back to State of Belief Radio. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
So, is it safe to assume the book was revised to remove all of the controversial material that made you so scary?
No, it is not. You know, it was revised to include mainly stories that I heard since the book came out from LGBT Catholics and families and friends to answer some of the more common questions and, you know, even critiques about the book.
Sure.
And to include even more facts and figures about the LGBT experience. So it's much longer, it's much fuller, and I hope for readers much richer.
You aren't some liberal ideologue writing in a hermit's cave. You're a mainstream Catholic magazine editor and author. You're even on the Vatican's communications team. So how can it be that despite all of that, your moderate pastoral tone in this book continues to be such a lightning rod?
Well, a couple of reasons. I think that's an excellent question. I think the first reason is there are, you know, people that have legitimate critiques and disagreements with my approach, you know, which is fine. I mean, not everybody has to agree with me. Second, there are a lot of people that haven't read the book, so they're responding to, you know, online articles and things that they may have heard. Funny enough, a Catholic bishop wrote a review of the book and said, I actually haven't read it yet.
Oh, my gosh.
But third, I think most disturbing is that there's a lot of hatred and homophobia out there, and that even the call to listen to LGBT people is enough to send people into hysterics. Mm. They basically say, well, you have to tell these people they're sinning first. And I say, well, what other group do we do that? My analogy is always Catholic business leaders. Imagine if you had a group of Catholic business leaders that were gathered together. And the first thing you said to them was, you people are all terrible because you're not paying a just wage and you're not taking care of the environment and you're not doing social justice things. And so they're the only group, LGBT Catholics, that is, that we start with condemnation. It really is quite striking. And I think a lot of that is just homophobia and ignorance and, sadly, hatred, which I don't think has any place in the church, in any church.
Absolutely. I don't want you to have to criticize any fellow Jesuits, Jim, but do you think the church could have done a better job in facing up to the question of LGBT persons over the past couple of decades, and that is part of why this is such an explosive topic today?
Well, that's actually a great insight. I had not thought about that before. That you're right. It is. That's very helpful. That it is a sign of how poorly we have catechized people, such that the only thing that many Catholics think about LGBT people is sinner, or shouldn't be Catholic, or terrible person, or, you know, other, I think, is the most common response. They're other. They're different. But for Jesus, there's no other. There's no person who's different. There's no person who's outside. There's no person who's not us. For Jesus, as I say in the book, there's no us and them. There's just us. And sadly, I think you're right. I think that the church has not catechized people sufficiently to help them see that it's all about an us. It's not us and them, it's us.
Mm-hmm. What is it that you write in your book that conservatives see as so provocative? Is it the respect, the compassion, or the sensitivity? In other words, what pose would you need to strike to mollify them?
I think the two things that are pushing their buttons are, number one, calling to an end to the firings of LGBT people simply because they're LGBT or they're in same-sex marriages. Because my point is that we don't do that with straight people. You know, I literally just got an email from a friend of mine who said he's being targeted in a group because he's in a same-sex marriage, and there's a couple, a straight couple, who are living together before being married, which is also against church teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this kind of targeting, and I call for an end to that. People don't like that. I call for us to look at the theological language that's used in the catechism, which says that LGBT people are objectively disordered. I say that that's very harmful to use that. But short of that, actually, there's nothing in the book that is against church teaching, against the Gospels, or anything. And the book has been approved by my Jesuit superiors. It's been endorsed by three cardinals, three archbishops, and three bishops. And so you have to conclude that a lot of this is just homophobia. And what they don't like is the idea that you would actually listen to people and that you might learn something new from people who are on the margins. But that's exactly what Jesus does. He goes to the margins. Look at someone like Zacchaeus in the tree, who's the tax collector, or the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, or the Roman centurion, or the lepers, or any number of people. So, you know, by asking them to do what Jesus did, I'm, you know, getting into trouble.
Jim, what happened that you finally said, I've been thinking about this all these years, and I'm going to write about it?
Well, in 2016, you might remember, there was the shooting of 49 people in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub, which was a largely gay nightclub.
Right.
And I noticed that in all other mass shootings and tragedies and disasters, the U.S. Bishops Conference and U.S. bishops individually will put out statements, as they should, right? So, for example, in Parkland, in the shooting in Florida, the bishops rightly put out a statement condemning it and expressing their support. But when the shooting happened of 49 gay people, they didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. All but a handful of bishops said nothing. And that really shocked me, and it disturbed me, and I did a little Facebook video about that, and then that turned into a talk, and then the talk turned into a book. So it really was that tragedy that sort of prompted me to do it.
My guest is Father James Martin, whose latest book has just been extensively revised and released in paperback. The title is Building a Bridge: How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. what was your major purpose in doing the revision?
Well, to include more stories from LGBT people themselves. The first book was really my ideas and my suggestions. And, you know, it dawned on me that there weren't a lot of stories and a lot of experiences from, there were a few, but not as many as there needed to be. And also, when I saw the reaction to the book and some of the questions, I thought, well, there were clearly some things that, you know, needed to be clear and needed to be clarified in the book, and so I'll do that. And I'll answer questions, the same questions that people always ask me. And I wanted to include more facts and figures, too. You know, there's a lot of good facts and figures, for example, about suicides. LGBT kids are 5 times more likely to try to commit suicide than straight kids. So those are the kinds of things that people need to know, because they need to recognize some of these issues are life issues, you know, as Catholics are fond of saying, pro-life issues. You know, we're talking about people killing themselves. And so I wanted to just basically incorporate what I'd learned in the last couple of months as I went around the country and talked about the book.
I'm also curious about what kind of feedback you have received from the LGBT community itself since you published.
Very positive. I think particularly within the Catholic Church, very positive. They're happy that this book has helped to, I would say, foster a conversation. I just got a couple emails from people who were saying that, gay Catholics. There, I think in the secular LGBT community, there's been a warm reception to it, but I think a lot of LGBT people also feel like I didn't go far enough. So, for example, you know, I don't and I can't and I won't, talk about same-sex marriage or same-sex relations, and I think they expected me to do that, but that's, the book's about dialogue and prayer. It's not about, you know, sexual morality. Mm-hmm. From a lot of bishops and clerics, they say, oh, the book went too far. And from some LGBT people, they say, well, it didn't go far enough. And I say, well, that's the point of the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole point. You take a step toward one another, knowing that, you know, in the middle is dialogue and listening and encounter. One of the great lines of Pope Francis is a culture of encounter, really listening to people and taking them seriously and not writing them off. And, that again, that's what Jesus does. You know, one of the things I like to say is in the story of Zacchaeus, as you know, in the Gospel of Luke, when Jesus offers mercy to the tax collector, one of my favorite lines, which has become very important to me, which I never really looked at, was, and the crowd began to grumble.
That's right. I've overlooked that too. Is there one or two pieces of correspondence that you have received related to the book that really stuck with you as important?
Yeah, I just got one today, funny enough, and I can probably call up my phone. The one that's further back is one from a phone call from a man who is autistic, who said that his parish he's gay. He just came out to his parish priest, and he said that his parish priest told him he could no longer receive communion.
My goodness!
So you know you have these crazy stories from people.
Yeah.
And here I'll read you just one I got today from a mother. Dear Father Jim, as a mother of 3 sons, the youngest of whom is gay, I can't thank you enough for your compassionate and loving advocacy for LGBT people within the church. You are doing tremendous work, and I pray that one day more priests, bishops, Catholic people, and people of all faith backgrounds will come to accept LGBT people. My son is one of the very best people I know. He is kind and compassionate to all. It hurts my heart behind words to think of the discrimination and vitriol he has already encountered, but you give me hope that change is happening. Thank you. God bless you, Father Jim. So, you know, I really, that's who I'm doing it for.
In the subtitle of your book, you write about a relationship of respect, compassion, and sensitivity between the Catholic Church and the LGBTQ community. Where are we in the development of that relationship?
We are in the first stages because we are not even talking to one another. So one of the things that I encourage also the LGBT community to, as you indicate, treat the hierarchy and priests and sisters and decision makers with respect, compassion, and sensitivity. And one of the things I had to say in the new book, which is something that LGBT people have said to me, is that we'd love to, but we can't even get a chance to talk to them.
Yeah.
Because we're not in their world, and they, in a sense, sometimes refuse to talk to us. And so we are still just at the, we're just still taking baby steps.
Yeah.
We're still getting to know one another. Now, I think it's happening, and I hope that the book will help it happen more, but we're at the very beginning of all that.
In the Roman Catholic Church, the hierarchy particularly, are you seen as out of bounds in opposition to the church, or someone trying to move the church toward people whom the church needs to affirm and embrace?
Well, it depends who in the hierarchy you talk to. The book has the approval of Cardinal Kevin Farrell, who is the prefect of the Vatican's Commission on Family, Laity, and Life. Okay, it has Cardinal Tobin's approval, the Archbishop of Newark. Cardinal Supich has approved it. So there are a lot in the hierarchy that are very supportive of the book, you know, going so far as to formally approve it. Archbishop Wilton Gregory in Atlanta and on and on. But, you know, there are some that don't agree with it. Now, I don't think anyone thinks I'm out of bounds. I think the people who disagree with me think I'm pushing the envelope a little too far. But the book, as I said, you know, it went through all the right approvals. And it's, as a Jesuit, you have to get every book approved. And it has to go through what's called a theological censor. That's the actual title, the censor of books. And it did. It passed. And so, again, you know, the gospel is just difficult for people.
Yes.
And listening to people, you know, the crowd began to grumble.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great line to remember. Well, I don't know what amount of authority a Baptist has for you, but just from my perspective, you have done a great piece of work and something that was badly needed, not just in the Catholic Church, but in many others. Father James Martin is editor at America Magazine. He's been appointed to the Vatican Communications Secretariat. His important book, Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity, has been extensively revised and just released as a paperback. Jim, you're doing great work. I hope you will stay at it. It's always great to talk with you, and I thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, my friend, and you do speak with authority, and I'm very pleased that you like the book. Keep me in your prayers.
Take care of yourself.
God bless.
Pro-born. A former evangelical on the single-issue politics of white Christians. Now, that's the provocative title of a recent Religion Dispatches article authored by Dr. Bradley Onishi of Skidmore College. A powerful political force in our nation, white evangelicals, did more to usher Donald Trump into the Oval Office than any other bloc of voters. And they've been incredibly busy collecting on their investment of political and moral capital in pursuit of their culture war agenda. In light of this, I'm thankful to have Dr. Onishi with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Your identity as an evangelical originally is very similar to my identity for many, many years. I came to a point in my days with Southern Baptist where I began to question what was going on. I know you have been through that questioning process. So I'd like to hear a quick description of that process for you, if you don't mind.
Sure. You know, as you can imagine, it was complicated. I was a youth minister by the time I was 18 and in full-time ministry by the time I was 20. And so I worked in a church where there was, you know, many people, especially young people, who looked up to me. As a young person myself, there wasn't much room to kind of explore questions. You know, my dark night of the soul wasn't very capacious in terms of the spaces I could kind of reach out and test uncertainties in my faith.
Mm-hmm.
So it was painful, and it was difficult, and I expressed that in the article. However, you know, the most important things demand our attention. And so over the years, I reflected on where my priorities were and where I thought the priorities of my faith should be and et cetera. And so, you know, it's not an overnight thing, but I arrived kind of where I arrived. And so looking back, it's not easy, and there are still painful relationships and different things, but that's what faith is. It's working through the hardest things.
There is also this problem of seeing people around you that you have so much in common with, seemingly comfortable with the status quo, and you've liked these people through the years, and you can't understand now how the differences can be so great, and that adds to the struggle as well. At least it did for me. Was that true for you?
It was, and you know, in many ways, I had a kind of a blessing and a curse in the sense that I moved for the first time away from home all the way over to the United Kingdom. So I went from California to the UK. Mm. That was really painful to be apart from those I loved, and to be apart from them during a time I knew my identity was changing. On the other hand, it provided for the first time in my life space to explore every question and every doubt, and I did that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've gone through the different stages of grief, honestly, in terms of anger and resentment and sadness, and those things are persist in my life with friends and family, but I love them, and I know they love me, and we do our best, even through what at times are incredibly strong disagreements.
I know it was a long process, but was there a moment that was kind of a breaking point when you said, I just can't do this anymore?
Well, as I outlined in the article, you know, I have vivid memories of being in that voting booth during the presidential election between John Kerry and George W. Bush. And I remember sort of thinking to myself that there was a very good chance, you know, that many of the things that the Democratic platform in general aligned with what I took to be the gospel. And yet there were these sticking points. And I mean, I remember talking about this with friends and family and elders, right? It came down to how could you vote to essentially, in their mind, right, condone the murder of millions of unborn babies.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that was a logic I had to work through, and it took time. But that was a breaking point.
Sure.
You know, that was a moment I thought, I'm not sure I can do this anymore. I'm not sure I can reduce my world to these lines.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure the world is this full of 90-degree angles. And, you know, it wasn't an overnight process. But from that point, from that moment in that voting booth, I really resolved it. I was gonna do this differently, no matter what it took.
Yeah. So would you talk about the black and white relationship you had with reproductive rights as a person of faith and as a voter?
Yeah, you know, in my community, as I assume in many evangelical communities across the country, there were murmurs at times of being dissatisfied with certain conservative leaders who were meant to be people of faith. But those concerns just were never, ever, ever going to be strong enough to trump the fact, right, that the Republican and conservative message aligned with the sort of anti-abortion message. And so, you know, what that did is not only provide a sort of like clear pathway on where to vote, but it provided a clear pathway on shutting off one's mind to the complexities of all the other aspects of being a citizen in a democracy. And so I've really come to see that not as an act of faith. That's an act of unfaith. When you pretend that the most important things in life are that simple, you are not acting on faith. You are creating a synthetic certainty that is the antithesis of faith. And so to me, you know, that kind of logic, although it seemed airtight as a participant in an evangelical church, unraveled. And and that was kind of the linchpin that unraveled my participation in evangelicalism writ large.
Hmm. As you look back on it, do you consider part of the gospel of life begins at conception to be propaganda?
Well, I now teach classes on religion and politics, and especially the United States. And what I try to show my students, and this has worked differently as I've taught in the South and in up here in the Northeast, has been to show that, yes, there is a history of evangelicals aligning themselves with a conservative platform on the basis of reproductive rights. There's also many other historical contingencies involved in that creation. And so, you know, in my classes, we start from, you know, what happens in the 50s and 60s and 70s with the moral majority, and we go forward. And we sort of examine how these alignments became so airtight. And it can be construed as propaganda. in a very pessimistic vein, sure. Are there those who propagate this message for sort of pure political gain? Yes. Are mm-hmm. there many others, people who I know and love, who sort of approach these things with what they take to be sincere hearts? Yes. Unfortunately, it's hard to divorce the two at this point in our political culture.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are some people that taught me some of those values that I now look back on and think, well, you know, they weren't just talking about values. They were talking about politics then, and I didn't get it.
Yes.
And that's a difficult one to deal with.
I think that's right. You know, what's funny is, you know, in the years that I describe in the article as a young man, I didn't ever consider myself to be a political person mm-hmm. because I didn't need to be.
Yeah.
I had values that determined how I would vote, and those not only determined how I would vote, but they meant I didn't have to engage, right, all of the difficult complexities, right, of the political arena because I already had my ballot set. Mm-hmm. I already had my check marks. And because of the linchpin of reproductive rights, I didn't have to sort of question, right, where and when I should move those check marks. They were already set. You know, it was a click one box, all the boxes fill in. When I was taught about values, right, I was being taught about politics. One of the things I still try to talk about with my evangelical friends is it's not really possible to be apolitical when you're talking about values,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right.
Those things go hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah. Brett, are you able to speculate about why this life begins at conception is now so central to evangelical identity and activism?
I think the perspective I'm trying to outline in the article is that, on one hand, right, there are many, many people who have sincere belief that they don't want to support things related to abortion because they do believe that somehow that is related to the ending of innocent lives, et cetera. Mm-hmm. However, on the other hand, what I tried outlining in the article is that it's aligned because it, again, puts one on firm ground. You know, the argument that I think is counterintuitive that many people don't want to hear is that, right, faith means being uncertain. It means doubt. Mm-hmm. It means not knowing for sure. And so, to me, this represents, right, the sort of antithesis of faith in the name of faith. You get to check off all the political boxes, stand on firm ground, not have to engage issues related to immigration or drone warfare or stem cell research or whatever the issues may be, because you're already set apart. You're standing on a city on a hill, and none of the messiness of the political life can touch you. And so, yes, right, there are sincere beliefs. There's also a quietism that I think is disturbing, and that's the part I'm ashamed of, right? When you opt out of living with your fellow citizens in a democracy, that's problematic, and I think this platform, you know, serves that function.
Well, that's very well stated, I think. Brad, I know a lot of progressive people view white evangelicals as driven by two issues, not just one. The idea that the rights of LGBT Americans are inevitably in holy war-level conflict with the rights of conservative Christians seems just as powerful and often more loudly expressed than the issue of abortion. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
I don't want to simplify this discussion, you know, surrounding evangelicals and politics. You know, I don't want to engage in the reductive enterprise that I'm sort of describing as the antithesis of, you know, of faith. What I would say is I think that sort of a cry against the LGBTQ plus community provides another platform of certainty. Mm-hmm. And so if you can just draw straight lines and not engage, right, any discussions regarding sexuality, gender, et cetera, if you can just draw a line and say, forget about it. If the lines cross, it's wrong, it's sinful, it goes against my theology or my understanding of God's plan for creation, well, then you don't have to engage, right? You have yet another battlefront on which you can sort of wage a war that appears to have straight lines and no doubt. And so I think those things are related, but in certain ways. But I guess the main way for me is their logic, right? Their logic of certainty.
Yeah.
If I believe this, not only can I disengage from, right, the body, right, the suffering, vulnerable body of queer people, mm-hmm. right, of trans teenagers, mm-hmm. okay? But I can also separate myself from the issue of worrying about how my democracy will include or exclude them, right? I can disengage carnally, and I can disengage politically. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, to me, the heart of the issue.
Are there any forces inside modern white evangelicalism that you think could serve to moderate the single-minded focus that you describe in your article?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I read the research and the data that says that younger evangelicals have more complex views of LGBTQ issues than their elders. And, you know, it's unpredictable. When the tragedy at Parkland happened a couple of weeks ago, I really was resigned to the kind of same old cycle, right? Tragedy, outcry, and then forget. And what we've seen is something different. Now, I don't know what the result will be, but I point to that just to say there could become a time when young evangelicals sort of realize that the marriage of a certain conservative politics and their faith no longer fits, that they may come to see that those things are not permanently entangled. And so if things have been unpredictable since Trump's election, I would say, you know, maybe it's all up for grabs. Maybe what Parkland is showing is that there is a generation that will call their elders bluff on a nihilistic approach to the most important things in life. But I don't know.
Bradley Onishi is assistant professor of religion at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. His Religion Dispatches article is headlined Pro-Born, a former evangelical on the single-issue politics of white Christians, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. I really appreciate you being with us today. Know that you're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to talk today.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Please be sure to join us next week for a really special program, as I'll be joined once again by the Right Reverend Bishop John Shelby Spong. At the age of 86, he has just published the latest in a very long list of important books. The title is Unbelievable: Why Neither Ancient Creeds Nor the Reformation Can Produce a Living Faith Today. Don't miss Bishop John Shelby Spong next week. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.